Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Vertical Space, a podcast at the intersection of technology and flight. We are your hosts, Jim Barry and Luka Tomjanovic, and here we look at the most important forces shaping the market of advanced air mobility, with a particular focus on why and how they matter to those building a business in this very exciting and growing industry.
If you're only able to travel an hour a day simply because that you're a human being, the value of your conveyance depends on how many places are you can go that you want to go. You can calculate just how valuable it actually would be to have a flying car of various different parameters.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to The Vertical Space. We found out about Josh Hall from a previous podcast guest, and after reading a terrific review of his book in the Wall Street Journal from just a few months ago, the book being Where is My Flying Car? And then reading the book, we realized he'd be a great guest to have in their vertical space. For those of you who've read the book, and as you'll hear during the podcast, you got to hold on to your hat because you're in for a wild but fun ride. Josh distills the future of the flying car, as he calls it, into a few clear points and takeaways, which you'll hear in the podcast, including how to calculate and realize the value of the flying car, or the VTOL, or the Advanced Air Mobility Vehicle, including that the faster the transportation, further you can spread out your base. You'll hear about many areas to be considered as we realize our future of advanced air mobility, including different sources of energy, the energy dependence of many of our greater innovations, and the energy required for the flying car and advanced air mobility overall, focusing on just one innovation at a time, nanotechnology, and nanotech fuel cells. He also talks about the Machiavelli effect, and then failures of nerve and failures of imagination. The topic of trusted autonomy is pretty cool, and his three points of advice to leaders in the advanced air mobility today, and his advice to entrepreneurs. In his book, he talks a lot about why the flying car has yet to be realized. In this podcast, we focused almost all of our time on what it's going to take to make the flying car and advanced air mobility a reality. Enjoy.
This episode of the Vertical Space podcast is brought to you by UAvionics. UAvionics is the leader in low size, weight, and power certified avionics for manned, unmanned, and advanced air mobility aircraft. Let UAvionics help you achieve your goals, whether that be type certification, airspace access, or beyond visual line of sight operations. UAvionics has certified and certifiable communications, navigation, and surveillance avionics for your aircraft. So head over to uavionics.com or Google it to see how you can start flying safer and move your platform forward into shared airspace.
Jay Storr's Josh Hall is the author of Where is My Flying Car? He is an independent futurist and author. In previous careers, he studied artificial intelligence and designed supercomputers for the Pentagon. He founded the Usenet Psi Nanotech Group in the 1980s and was its moderator for 10 years. He wrote a book about nanotechnology and was founding scientist for a molecular CAD startup. He wrote the first book about the machine ethics 10 years before the field got renamed AI Safety. He appeared in the movie The Singularity is Near and has been invited to speak at venues as varied as MIT, Hollywood, the American Philosophical Association, and the University of Western Bohemia. Now residing with his wife on beautiful Chesapeake Bay, he holds a private pilot's license and dabbles in aerodynamics design under the auspices of the Eastern Shore Flying Cars. Josh Hall, welcome to the podcast, and please say hello to Luka Tomjanovic.
Hi, Luka, and happy to be here.
Thanks, Josh. Great to have you.
Josh, I'm afraid to ask the first question, which is, having read about your book and read up about you, this could be a long answer. Is there anything that very few in the industry agree with you on?
Well, assuming you want to define the industry as the EVTOL sector, I think that almost by definition, everybody disagrees with me and they're trying to put batteries in their flying machines. And I think that's a silly thing to do. Now, as I did say in the book, I don't think it's necessarily a major problem because most of the aerodynamic progress, experimentation, and development that they do is still going to be valuable as soon as somebody comes up with something that is a, a reasonable drop-in replacement for batteries. I'm thinking in terms of early nanotech fuel cells, but right now you could use an APU, a turbine specifically adapted to drive a generator, or some combination. I mean, if you have, you know, say half an hour's reserve in a battery and you use the fueled power source for the main parts of the flight, you got something that would beat almost any of the battery powered VTOLs out there right now.
Yeah, if there's one thing that you can never have enough of on board an aircraft, that's energy. And as these aircraft mature and they start resembling actual products in which people enjoy sitting in, so you need environmental control, you need equipment and technology to be all-weather capable, so de-icing and all of the other things that make a robust commercial aircraft actually marketable, then all of a sudden you start accumulating more and more demand on onboard energy systems. Not to mention that, I mean, as a pilot, you never fly to the margin. You always leave yourself even more than what's legal or required in terms of, you know, VFR or IFR requirements for reserves.
Yeah, well, and one of the things I noticed about some of the earlier attempts at the EV2Ls is that their total energy didn't meet the legal requirements for reserve. So you're totally right as far as that's concerned. But there's another point besides all the things that you mentioned where you need extra power, energy, and so forth, is that one of the things I go to a great deal of trouble in the book to try and understand is how valuable is a flying car? And one of the things that turns out to really make it valuable is its speed and its range. And if you don't have those, and including a specifically range, you're going to cut off a large part of what would have been the value of a vehicle with the same flying characteristics, but not the same amount of endurance.
Yeah, and I would caveat that range as it relates to the network model, right? Because range can work, but if you need multiple, you know, legs in order to make close the entire business case in terms of the infrastructure, then that can be an additional demand on top of the actual range that you need for the passenger's sake. But perhaps it's good to maybe clarify some definitions up front. The eVTOL market is certainly a subset of what we are discussing in the podcast, but we are broadly talking about advanced air mobility. So that can be anything from small drones to traditional aircraft. So eVTOLs are just a subsegment of it.
Okay. Well, if you take the industry as a whole, there are plenty of people who agree with me on a whole bunch of stuff. So I don't have that much more of an answer for question number one.
So Josh, why are so many in the eVTOL UAM space battery-based?
Ooh, I think it's basically they're looking at Tesla and saying, yeah, we can do this too. As someone who has spent a large part of his career trying to do innovations in technology, one of the hard but necessary lessons that you learn when you do that is one at a time. People who do this tend to have lots of really great ideas and be very bright and be good at making innovations work and so forth. But even so, you have a really horrible track record for projects which try to do even just two major innovations at the same time. So do one, make it work, and then look for the next one. And batteries is a non-necessary innovation for flying machines.
Having read your book, and it was terrific. So the book, Where is My Flying Car? We could go into so many different categories in this talk. We want to talk about why we don't have a flying car today, which you spent a lot of time in the book. What we'd like to be able to do is spend a little more time on, you know, what does the future look like and what do we need to do to bring about advanced air mobility vehicles? But we have to ask in the beginning, why don't we have the flying car? And if you could summarize it in a few minutes, you know, 150 pages of your book, that would be terrific.
I'll give it a shot. Well, the basic thing is that when I started looking at this, I looked not just at flying cars, but at a whole bunch of other predictions of what technology would be like now and for the next 50 years, as seen from the point of view of 1962 when the Jetsons first appeared. Well, it turns out that there were a lot of people, and I go to science fiction writers more often than other predictors, but I looked at the people who were doing, you know, quote, serious, unquote, futurism, and people who were both science fiction writers and scientists, such as Asimov and Arthur C. Clarke and so forth, and took down a whole list of all their predictions. And then I plotted on one scale whether they had come true or not, or how much they had come true, and on another axis, just how much energy they used. And I was expecting to get sort of a tilted blob, you know, a two-dimensional bell curve of results, but slightly tilted so that the more you needed energy, the less likely it was to be true. And I was flabbergasted when I plotted this out. It wasn't like that at all. It was as if you had filled the whole page with that and then just chopped off the top right half of it with a machete. There was just a clear line that said, if you use more energy than this, you're not going to succeed. And I was, as I say, I was flabbergasted that there was a much stronger indication than I had expected when I started in on the predictions and so forth. So that's the first thing. There's a huge energy dependence on the success of the predictions of the people in the 50s and 60s who are writing about this stuff. The second thing is more directly connected. If you go back and do the analysis of a flying car of the kind that would be enough more valuable than a ground car, that it could take the market over and engender a major move to flying cars, it's going to have to be something like a megawatt of power. And that just places it well above that chop-off line. So essentially, you can back the story of the flying car into the story of all the missing technologies, and it's due to whatever it is that caused us not to have the amount of energy available that reasonable people in the 50s and 60s expected.
So tell us about nanotech fuel cells and how they solved that problem.
Well, as a matter of fact, almost all the engines that we have to use fossil fuels or any other kind of fuel, whether it's green hydrogen or petroleum, essentially thermalize the energy. And in your car engine turns about 30% or so of the energy inherent in the gasoline and its ability to oxidize with the air into useful work, and the rest of it just goes right out the tailpipe. Well, if you had the ability to control the reactions one atom or molecule at a time, and you get closer to this with current day PEM type fuel cells, although you're still looking at more like 50% than 100%, you could triple the amount of energy you get from a specific piece of fuel, and you could use a lot more different kinds of fuel. One of my favorite candidates is anhydrous ammonia, you know, reduced to a cooled and compressed liquid. You'd be looking at something roughly the energy density of gasoline, and yet all the emissions you would produce would be water and nitrogen, which is already the major component of the air. But hydrogen would work. All sorts of other energy carriers would work. I mean, you could burn natural gas, you could burn any kind of hydrocarbons, and you would be essentially a lot more efficient in your energy use. I think ultimately, let's say by the end of the century, we don't want to be using chemical energy in these things at all. We want to be using something that's nuclear in origin, but that's a lot further from what we're capable of doing now than the fuel cells.
Josh, tell us a little bit about, there were a couple of things that stood out that I thought were really interesting as to, you know, why we're not where we are. One is the Machiavelli effect.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is nothing new. I mean, Machiavelli made this observation 500 years ago. And what he said was that nothing is, more dangerous or difficult to do than to introduce a new order of things, because all the people that succeeded and profited under the old order are going to be against you, and they're the powerful ones. And all the people who might do well under the new order of things don't know they are, and they're unorganized and don't have a lot of power in the current system. And so everything's stacked against you. And this is, you know, this is just part of the human condition. That's just the way things work and have done since well before Machiavelli wrote it down. But for 500 years, it's been written down. And everybody who tries to innovate in a major way and change the world has run into this. There are really two kinds of things that I ran into when I was trying to figure out why we don't have flying cars. And that one and the regulation and all the other, you know, sort of normal stuff that keeps you from getting things done are in one category. And the other category is something that I find a lot harder to understand. And that is that sometime in the 60s, people forgot that energy is the most valuable thing that we have. There's one set of people who refer to it as the master resource. Energy is something that if you don't use your own muscles, you're really going to need some form of other energy. And you have to do that to get anything done. And yet, sometime in the 60s and going into the 70s and becoming part of the culture, people forgot that energy is not only necessary for progress, but it's necessary for preventing poverty and keeping people from freezing in the dark and all the other things. They started just taking it for granted. And so one of the things that I really tried to look into in the book and try to understand was, how can it be that almost all of leading edge Western civilization became stupid and evil at the same time? In the 60s. And that's the real mystery. I tried to investigate and to explain to some extent.
Josh, what's the takeaway for entrepreneurs to adjust to this innovation inertia, for lack of a better word, that you're describing here with the Machiavelli effect?
Well, it's pretty hard to say. I mean, there are people who would say something like, if you want to found a flying car company, you need to hire 5 engineers and 50 lawyers. I think that one of the things you could do as an entrepreneur is try to find a path that doesn't have roadblocks on it. The classic case in advanced aero mobility would be drones. And basically, there was a cutout for gadgets less than 50 pounds. And with technological development, turns out that the quadcopter type drone was a really nice little optimal point in the space of designs, and they just took off. And if you're trying to do something like that, you're finding a spot where the roadblocks aren't there yet and stealing a march on the forces of evil.
So kind of to the same topic, you talk about the failures of nerve and failures of imagination, but in some ways, a lot of the vehicles of today don't lack for either, do they? Describe it first, if you could, both.
Another one of the great things that happened in 1962, besides the Jetsons, was the publication of Profiles of the Future by Clark. And those are his phrases. And he's talking about why technological predictions so often fall on their faces. And he divides them into these two categories, failures of nerve and of imagination. So I use that as a way of looking at predictions. But I think the key thing that I did discover, the fact that we've, since roughly the 70s, instead of having a nice, easily rising, reliable curve of more and more energy available that I refer to as the Henry Adams curve, we had a flat line. So all of the people who did predictions in the 50s and 60s, you know, the science fiction writers and the futurists and so forth, had every right to expect that curve of increasing energy use per capita was going to continue. And so they made predictions quite reasonably along those lines. And then it flatlined. And that was not really a failure of nerve, because they didn't have any serious reason to expect that to happen. So it was a failure of the imagination.
Josh, let's move now on to, what's the value of the flying car? What's the value of advanced air mobility? And what do you think has to be done to make it a reality?
Well, I think that the broader question of advanced air mobility covers a whole bunch of things besides the flying car per se. But the flying car is the one that I personally analyzed. And so just to be able to get some actual numbers in there, I looked at what people did as far as traveling was concerned, and I discovered something that I didn't know, but it is apparently at least relatively well understood in the travel theory literature, which is that no matter what mode you use, whether you're walking on your own bare feet or driving in an air-conditioned car or anything else in between, the average person tends to want to travel about 1.1 hours a day. And the mode of travel tells you how far you can go and what area you can cover, and therefore how many opportunities that gives you. But whatever the mode is, you're only going to spend an hour or a little more a day doing it. And so the more your mode of travel can cover, the faster it goes, and the less wasted time you have, you know, sort of like if you're trying to cross San Francisco from Fisherman's Wharf to islands on the west side where they have all this the cool restaurants and stuff. You can spend 2 hours on a bus or 15 minutes in a car because you're waiting on the bus. The bus is always stopping and you're waiting for the bus and all that sort of stuff. And that's just one example. It happens to be one I've done. So the car saves you an awful lot of time. The more time you can save and the more things that you can do in the amount of time you have, which we will just simply estimate as being 1.1 hours, because that is the average, the more valuable your car is. As a result, the more you would be willing to pay for it, and therefore the more technologically sophisticated and so forth it could be. And there's every reason to believe that we could have climbed out of the regime where almost all personal travel is done in cars on the ground, as it was in the 60s, and gotten into a regime where some reasonable amount of people were able to fly. And I actually went and tried that as research for the book. I got an airplane, I got a pilot's license, and there's quite a lot of trips that are just so much nicer and easier to make in your airplane. And if I could fly that airplane from my driveway and it could go twice as fast as it does, I would use it a lot more. And it would be even that much more valuable to me.
It's interesting you bring this up. In my day job, I invest in early stage companies, and the firm is called Radius Capital. And part of the
Radius
Capital. So part of the significance of the name is this recognition of this constant radius of commute that you're discussing that just grows as new transportation systems become available. And in this particular case, with advanced air mobility, the radius does extend, and that allows you to reach existing destinations faster. But at the same time, it creates altogether new capabilities to access new destinations or do things that you previously didn't have. So it's almost a multidimensional expansion of the radius in case of as a benefit of advanced air mobility.
One of the things that I try to do is connect this to history, because basically if you ignore history, you're doomed to repeat it. And one of the more interesting books I read was by H.G. Wells. It was called Anticipations. And in the turn of the century, it was written right as the 20th century was starting. The big thing was, of course, the automobile. And he's predicting that cities could get bigger because people could get to more places in automobiles. And it's basically a really nice example of the same kind of analysis, but of something that's already happened. So you can look at the analysis, you can look at the history, and you can see what he got right and what he didn't get right. Criticize your own analysis accordingly.
Yeah, absolutely. We are victims of our own transportation systems. And whether this is prehistoric times when we're walking on foot, or horses and rails and streetcars and then cars, and then later, even more advanced modes of transportation, all of those changed how cities were built and where people chose to live and where they chose to raise their families. And we can see that certainly in the differences in cities in Europe and cities in the United States and big suburban areas. And that is a direct reflection of the transportation systems that were peaking at the time these changes were happening. But, let's talk about the automotive industry since you bring it up. Because I think there are a lot of great lessons and insights to be had there. What do you think we can learn from the early days of the automotive industry or tech adoption in general as we apply that to advanced air mobility and how it might evolve over time?
Well, I think one of the big things that you have to take into account is the reaction of the segments of society that you're not serving. Call that the Machiavelli effect, if you like, to the segment of society that you are serving. And I think one of the key things is that the easiest people to help are the people that need it the most. But the people who find it easiest to stop you are the ones who are opposed to that, because the people who need it the most are a threatening segment that would, threaten to overturn their preeminence or what have you, which is the entire dynamic of the Machiavelli effect. So, example, Henry Ford went out and specifically tried to make a car that the working man could afford. In fact, so that, the guys who worked in his factory could actually afford to buy his cars, and ultimately, essentially, succeeded. And, he had a lot of competitors who jumped on the bandwagon and so forth, but America became a car driving country. And it was by the 50s, it was expected that every family would have a car. But then what happened is that basically in the 60s and 70s, as far as I can understand it, the leading lights became very car hostile, and cities began to be designed to make driving as difficult as possible rather than as easy. And so when in the 30s, all the future histories and the people who were designing the city of the future and so forth had cities designed specifically to allow the cars to get through fast and go everywhere with as little traffic and so forth as possible, which means that the roads in the cities were multi-level, non-intersecting, and essentially the same way that you would design major data flow channels in a processor, which I have some experience at. Your typical processor has 10 levels of interconnect. Your typical city has one. And so any signal, any car going from point A to point B has to contend with all the other cars out there. So if you want to design a city to allow traffic to flow as optimally as possible, it would look a lot more like a processor and have many, many levels of interconnect with it so that the cars weren't always stopping and waiting for each other. And that would make the city much more car friendly. But the thing is that with a fast method of transportation, like a car or like any kind of aircraft, you don't have to make the city so dense. Everybody can get where they're going in the same amount of time on a much more spread out sort of design. And so the notion of the Jetsons, where, you know, everybody lives in a completely separate tower stuck up into the sky and they get from spot to spot in their flying cars, is perfectly possible. It's just that right now, the reigning orthodoxies and the power that be and so forth are essentially just take it for granted that that's bad, and they want to keep it from happening.
Right. Your first comment made me think of a picture that I've seen some time ago, and I think it was from the late 19th century, and it was a picture of a motor horse. It was a 500-pound engine that was embedded in something that looked like a horse, but it was built out of wood and metal. That was an early automobile, and it was made that way so that it wouldn't spook other horses and other people when they saw a horseless carriage cruising around town.
That
right?
is hilarious, yeah.
So I guess that's a great way to overcome some of these Machiavelli effect-induced barriers, right? To your point about serving the or reacting or addressing the customer that you're not necessarily serving, but whose buy-off you need.
Well, I think what actually happened in the 50s was that you began to see a motion in the direction of what I'm talking about, so much so that the Jetsons, when it came out in 62, was a reasonable expression of that. And that was that if you have faster transportation, you can just spread out your base. And that was happening. I mean, they called it urban sprawl, but the fact is that in the 50s and 60s, you began to see bedroom communities and so forth that were not part of a central core city, but from which people could get into the city and do business and so forth, just as fast as they could have done on a trolley car. It's interesting to try and understand why that trend stopped and reversed after the 70s. But I think, you know, basically car hostility is a key part of it. And the fact that cities quit being designed to be more and more friendly to cars and started being designed to be less friendly to cars.
What do you think is more responsible for the decrease in sensitivity and resistance to new technology over time? Do you think it's more technology itself, or is it public acceptance? So let me give you an example also back from the early days of the automotive industry. Roughly around the turn of the century, I've seen a video where a person stops their car before they go through a crossroad, and there was literally a procedure that they had to follow. They had to get out of the car, you know, honk the horn a couple times, go walk to the middle of the intersection and yell a couple times so that everybody, horses, people around would know that they're coming. And then as a last step, they would take out their shotgun and shoot it once just to make sure that, you know, everybody really knows that they're there. And then they would go back into the car and drive across the intersection. And fast forward, you know, several decades later, now people all of a sudden were okay with just using three lights.
Well, Yeah. Well, as a matter of fact, there were lots of laws like that. I mean, the classic one is you know, where if you're going to drive a car, you have to have a guy walking in front of the car, either carrying a red flag in the daytime or
I've heard that too. Yeah.
You know, what actually happened, and these were real laws, they got honored in the breach and people just ignored them. And a lot of progress happens that way.
Somewhere in the book, you mention something about the value of the car. So you talk about the 1 hour trip, and if you're in a flying car, you're going to get a lot more value. And as a result, the price of the car has to be X in order for people to feel that it's something that they can afford and get value from.
Oh, yeah, of course. That's the travel theory chapter. It, as far as I know, I'm the first one to really look into that in any kind of a mathematical way. I may well be completely whistling in the dark and everybody knows about it and so forth, but I'd never read about it. And I've read a lot about flying cars as research. So the basic point is, if you're only able to travel an hour a day simply because that you're a human being, the value of your conveyance depends on how many places are you can go that you want to go. And what I did was I simply calculated, given the amount of people, places, and distances that people actually travel, you can back calculate just how valuable it was to those people to do that. And there's some places that people will spend. I mean, I had two homes, for example, some back when I was actually writing the book, as a matter of fact, that were 7 hours apart. And so, you know, every so often I would actually do that 7 hour drive. But I wouldn't do it that often. The trick is, once I get an airplane, I could do it 2 hours. And it was a lot easier to do it. And so the airplane was worth a lot, because that was a trip I could make a lot more often than I would have done if I had only had a car. So if you take that and you take all those statistics and you back calculate into a profile of how much value there is for people to be able to go a certain distance in a certain amount of time, you can calculate just how valuable it actually would be to have a flying car of various different parameters. And I wound up, and this is still fairly non-precise because I'm working from a whole bunch of figures and the details would probably be different. But as a general back of the envelope calculation, you could say that if you had a car that you could take off from your own driveway and travel at approximately airliner speeds, I was using 400 miles an hour, it would be worth seven times as much as a car, which means that if you could build one that you could sell to people for seven times as much as a car, there'd be a market for it. And there's a surface, and it shows up in one of the pictures in the book, that allows you to say, okay, this is your latency and this is your speed, and that's how much your car is worth.
So we had a guest on recently who talked about, and Luca, correct me if I'm wrong, who talked about a vehicle that would be about $50,000. So roughly the same price as many cars today.
Are we talking about the heavy side? Because I actually offered to buy one. I said, boy, I want one of those.
As a result, you would think that a $50,000 aircraft with that kind of value would be attractive.
Oh, absolutely. The thing about the heavy side is it's one of these battery planes, and it would be worth twice as much as a personal car as it is if it had a different.
I guess we should clarify. It's not necessarily the heavy side, but one of its. One of the versions that will follow it, obviously. But yes, that was from.
And they have Chris. A different business model, and they're not selling it as a car to individuals and blah blah blah. Yes.
So if the cost per seat mile is somewhere below that value element, then it should be something that's attractive to today's travelers.
Yeah, and where I'm sitting is I'm not sure I can give you any guarantees if you're going to start a company and try and build that, because A, there's other things going on, and B, you know, it's a fuzzy calculation. And I can, I think, reasonably say that if you're going to try and sell the thing for 10 times that much, you'll never sell it.
Josh, what are the things are you excited about when you imagine the future of aviation?
Well, I just would really, if I started this over, I wouldn't have gotten a plane, I would have gotten a helicopter, because doing the VTOL business and landing on a dime and having that many more places to go or to put down in the case of an emergency is just a wonderful thing. And to me, it would have been worth the extra money. The ability to do the VTOL thing is really the exciting part for me to some extent, because I've already done the flying part. I think that's where a huge part of the value of a flying car lies. And it would just be really nice to experience that. And another thing is, though, is that the design for the flying car simply has not been done yet. The field is moving fast, and there are so many different things that people are being able to invent and put in there and so forth, that as a futurist, I'm always interested in just watching how things work out. So as far as the industry is concerned, this is one of the more exciting parts of it, just to see how it goes.
And what are your thoughts on some of the other aspects of advanced air mobility? For instance, cargo drones or delivery drones or other abilities for businesses to leverage this third dimension?
Oh, I think that's just happening. I had a guy come and do an estimate for putting a new roof on my house, and he shows up and he pops a drone out and he goes and takes pictures of it. And then he right. takes the pictures and he puts it back into his computer, and he comes back to me and he has pictures of my house with a new roof on it, you know, seen from up in the air as, you know, basically a little bit of CGI on top of his drone picture. And that's happening. I mean, that's out there right now. And basically any cool idea that you can have to put on top of that, have drones of the kind that we're talking about now. Mm-hmm. They're there and they're going.
You've done a fair amount of work in artificial intelligence. What will it take to develop trusted autonomy?
I think basically people have a very strong built-in algorithm, if you will, as to how you come to trust another person. I think that essentially we're going to have to, as we build AIs that we want people to trust, we're going to have to understand what people use to decide what to trust other people and do the same things in the robots. I would add that the things that people do trust and the things that they don't trust are not necessarily right. And I would hope, to the extent that I have anything to say about this field, that the people who are working on it try and understand places where people tend to trust systems and machines and even people that they shouldn't, and at least address that to the extent that we build AIs that we ought to trust, even though we don't know we should.
How far are we from understanding this trust criteria?
I really have no idea, quite frankly. I mean, I wrote a book about that 10 years ago, and I failed to get anybody interested in it. Yes, the trouble, if you're a futurist, you know, there's two things you can do, and one of them is wait too long, and the other ones be too early. And so I didn't get any traction on what I was calling machine ethics at the time. But now it's hot, and I find that there's a little bit of a disconnect between what I was thinking at the time and what people are thinking now with respect to it. I think, and this is just me and just my own personal history, that a lot of the mistakes that the people in the field are making now are exactly the same mistakes that people made when they thought they were about to build artificial intelligence in the 60s, when, you know, you had $1 million machine had 1 million words of memory in it, and there were three of them in the world. And yet they thought AI was right around the corner. And there's a whole bunch of mistakes that people made that is basically just because of the way people think about these things. And they're still thinking that way, and they're still making the same mistakes.
Before we get to some of our summary questions, I want to ask you a kind of a practical question. Yeah, there's hundreds of people making flying cars, let's say today, VTOL aircraft. And let's say there's the top 20 are in a room, and you've been asked to be the guest speaker, and they've all read your book, and they've all learned what has gone wrong in the past, and they want to learn from you to say, okay, what can we do right in the future? And you said, okay, there's three things I want you all to do to make this reality that we all, you know, yearn for. What would be three things you'd recommend for them?
Well, the first thing would be get together and build a usable power system that everybody can use, and you know, make that job one, because once you have copious electric power, given the things that people are using now, and mostly electric motors and either propellers or ducted fans or what have you, or if you're getting really interesting, the ionic thrusters. There's a machine out there now that's been in stealth mode up until very recently. Uses a lot of electricity. Build a gadget that produces copious amounts of electricity from a power plant and fuel source that is light enough for a V2L flying machine. So that would be point one. Point two is be careful about gusty winds. And that's something I haven't seen people looking at. And I've been playing with it, but you know, as a almost disinterested amateur. But that's the one thing that keeps people from actually flying in car-sized vehicles. They get airsick. So I have a private plane, but it's actually a fairly heavy private plane. It's still a four-seater, but it's a bit slower than some, but it's a rock. And so when you come in and the winds are gusty and so forth, you don't get nearly as airsick in it. And I knew that going in because on the Eastern Shore, the little tiny spit of land between the Chesapeake Bay and the Atlantic, the winds are swirly and gusty, and you have to worry about that. There are plenty of people who just wouldn't fly with me because they'd been up there once and they don't want to deal with it. You want to have a machine that actually is capable of giving you a smooth ride in, you know, winds that are changing direction every second. And third, all I could say for number three is good luck.
Okay. So those would be the three. So the power systems and be mindful and calibrate for the strong winds would be the big two. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
There's probably something else that I'll think of just as soon as we quit here, but those are the ones that occur to me off the top of my head.
So you published your book and then the Wall Street Journal did looks like a really good review on it.
Please. It was nice. It was very nice. Yeah.
What do you think some of the leaders in the AAM or VTOL market took from it that you think could most help them to move forward?
Well, I think it would probably have to be travel theory, that you have to understand where the value that your machine provides comes from. Mm-hmm. And that would have to be what I would say to anybody who is actually trying to make a go in the industry.
So Josh, great talking about the book and the lessons learned from the book. So you have a lot of experience here, and let's say you have a group of 10 entrepreneurs in VTOL and in advanced air mobility overall, and they wanted to spend their time and money in the areas that have the greatest impact on the industry and the greatest return to them financially. What would you have them focus on?
I would say once you understand your market, and there are many different business models there. Most of the ones, especially the battery powered ones, seem to be looking at speeding up travel across a city because of traffic and that kind of thing. My calculations tend to indicate that that's not where the major value of these things is. So you need to understand, you know, not only the capabilities of your machine, but the needs of your target market.
If you fast forward 5 years and 10 years out, what does the industry look like?
I think we're probably going to have some of these things going. There are several of the companies that look like they're going to get certificated and at least begin to try and put their machines into service. So I think in 5 years, they're going to begin to get some experiential feedback as to, you know, what works and what doesn't, not just technologically, but economically. If I'm right, that this is the way the market works. People will begin to discover the stuff that my mathematical models were indicating if I was right, and something else if I was wrong. But I think that you'll probably begin to see a correction in 5 years and a shakeout, simply because people will know a lot more about how you can actually make money in this field. 10 years out, you're going to see an industry that's fairly transformed on the basis of the stuff that they've discovered 5 years out.
Josh, what's the most common misconception or misunderstanding of the topic, let's say of flying cars or VTOL or AM overall?
I think it's mostly that people are thinking of flying cars as if they were going to be like ground cars, and there's going to be, you know, Aunt Tilly sitting at the wheel and making every decision. I think that the basic operating dynamic of a flying car is going to be a lot closer to a self-driving car where you tell it where to go, even if you have a joystick in your hand. A lot of the stuff that you, the pilot of a, say, 1960s V2L machine would have to do is going to be automated and basically part of the nervous system of the machine.
And as we wrap up, what's the one point that you would want our audience to most take from your comments?
The one point is that the future is wide open. There are so many things we could do. There's so many things that people are trying to do. Other things that you think, wow, that's crazy, because that's part of the space age, atomic age dreams of the 50s and 60s, but that are in fact quite possible for us to accomplish if we simply decide that we want to do them. All of that stuff is still there, and all those dreams can still be made true. All
right, thanks a lot, Josh. Thank you.
Thank you. This has been fun.
Yeah, delight.
Likewise.
Thanks, Josh.
All right, that's a wrap for today. Thank you for listening to the Vertical Space Podcast. Reach out if there are topics that you would like us to discuss, and goodbye until the next episode. Unless mentioned, this podcast is in no way endorsing or promoting any person and or company mentioned, and all opinions within the podcast are solely that of the presenters. The Vertical Space makes no guarantees, warranty, or representation of any information given in this podcast. Any information given is for informational purposes and should be used at your own risk. This podcast is for general, educational, and entertainment purposes only.